There's a new exhibit at the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum on the Mall downtown, and I'm hoping to get down to it. I haven't seen it yet. The reason why I want to see it is because it's something I've read a lot about over the years. It's called the Jefferson Bible. And it has frequently been an object of interest to a lot of people, especially people who like to listen to and read about the teachings of Jesus, but they have a hard time accepting the notion that he was the Son of God. What is the Jefferson Bible? Well, it's a book that was personally produced by Thomas Jefferson, one of the founding fathers of the United States. And what he did, he actually started working on it when he was a young man, but he finished it when he was aged. Really, he finished it a few years before he died. He finished it in 1820. And what he did was he wanted to capture the essence of the teaching of Jesus. And so he gathered up several copies of the Bible, and he cut and pasted. If you look closely at this photograph of one of the Jefferson Bibles, and these were really just produced for his own work, not for the public. But of course, they became an interesting artifact. People have been fascinated by it. If you notice carefully, he's pasted pieces of paper in this book. And here is actually one of the Bibles that he used, an 1804 version of the King James translation, as a source book. And you can see where he took a penknife and he cut quotes and sections from the Gospels. And it's that process that he used to compile what he called, the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. Well, you may be wondering, well, what did he cut out and what did he not cut out? Well, what he put in his Bible were just the teachings of Jesus about morality and about God and things like that. What he left out were all the references to miracles. The references to the virgin birth of Jesus in the New Testament. The references to the resurrection of Jesus recorded in all four Gospels. As well as in between of all the various miracles that Jesus performed. Jefferson rejected these as legendary. Why? Because he didn't believe miracles occurred in the natural world. He was very much a product of what is called the Enlightenment. And he believed that what we know to be true is what we can observe with our own eyes to be true. And that there are certain natural laws that we observe in the world, and that a miracle couldn't take place because it was a violation of natural laws. Which means this account found in Matthew, the 14th chapter, was not included in Jefferson's Bible. Where we're told of Jesus, immediately he made the disciples get in the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After he'd sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And then when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long distance from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. They said, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid." Can a man really do that? Can a man walk on water? I've never seen it. You've never seen it. And we can go out to the lake here behind this building, and we can gather on the shore, and we can get a volunteer. Maybe somebody who's got some old pants on. And let them give it a try. And even from what is typically called the scientific method, we can let him do it 100 times. And we can record the data about what happens every time he steps into the water. And you and I would expect that every time he steps into the water, he's not going to stand on the surface. He's going to sink. See, Jefferson's senses in experience has told him that a man couldn't walk on the water. And so when he formed his own personal copy of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, he left that out. But here's another question. Why did Matthew include it? Why did Mark include it? Why did Luke include it? And why did Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four of them, record miraculous events that we're not familiar with? Well, as Rick mentioned, we're involved in the series Jesus Fact or Fiction. What we're trying to do is sort through and separate in our own thinking, because that's what matters the most from a personal standpoint. Not what other people say about Jesus, but what's crucial is what you think about Him. And trying to sort through and separate what is true and what is not true. Last week, we looked at the four Gospels. And we saw that they're critical documents in this process of trying to figure out who Jesus is. And there are four documents that should require of us the utmost attention. Why? Well, because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John had the greatest access to the events of Jesus' life. Matthew and John were disciples who witnessed themselves many of these things. Mark and Luke were people who knew the witnesses, who drew from the testimony of the witnesses. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are what would be called primary sources. And so from their access to the things that were happening, and them writing about them just a few years, a few decades later, they require our utmost attention, not what somebody wrote 100 or 300 or 1,000 or even 2,000 years later about Jesus. They have the greatest access. We also saw that they require and deserve our attention because of the document evidence, the manuscript evidence, the hand copies in the original language. This is what commonly was done with ancient documents. Scribes, and that's what they're living, how they earn their living, would make copies. They didn't have mechanical copying. And so how we know what ancient documents said, whether it's something the Greeks wrote or the Romans wrote, is dependent upon those manuscripts that we uncover. Because those manuscripts written many centuries ago help us to understand that our current copies are accurate. And we saw last week that the evidence is astounding, that there are more New Testament Greek manuscripts about these books of the New Testament than any other collection of writings of ancient history. And that these manuscripts in the original Greek language go all the way back to just a few decades after the events took place. And so the manuscript evidence is just impressive. And that results and should result in us giving close attention to and looking at these documents as documents that we have today that were faithfully transmitted all the way back 2,000 years before. And we also saw how that the unselfish and the sacrificial work these men did in writing the story of Jesus and preaching the story of Jesus shows that they had pure motives. They did not gain earthly status or possessions. They were hurt. They suffered. They were persecuted. They were troubled because of their preaching, but they did not relent. There's really no room for a conspiracy here among these writers. Because of what they went through, it does not make sense that they thought what they were saying was untrue. But rather, they went to great extent and suffered greatly, even some to the death, because of their testimony that these things actually happened. So those three points, I want you to note also that the idea that these men had the greatest access to Jesus and what happened, that there is evidence through the manuscripts that what we have today is what they originally wrote, and the fact that they were so sacrificial and selfish, you know that you can close your New Testament and never open it and know those facts. There's plenty of evidence outside the Bible. Those three facts are true about these men having access, the manuscripts being so abundant, and the fact that they suffered greatly for their message. But of course, the New Testament verifies that too. And so here's where we're left. If there's so much legitimacy to the writings of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're to be taken seriously. Whether you completely accept everything they say or not, they should be taken seriously. Then if they're to be taken seriously, why do they write about things that are so extraordinary? Even things hard for us to believe. Like somebody walking on the water. I've never seen it. You've never seen it. So why should we believe it? Well, let's talk about miracles a little bit and understand sort of what the Bible is getting at when it records these things called miracles, sometimes called wonders or signs. Well, understand that a miracle is an event beyond what naturally and normally and commonly occurs. That it's not something that you see every day. And it's not something that is in the natural world what's to be expected. Like you take a rock and drop it off a building and it goes right to the ground because of gravity. Because the idea that a human being can't walk on the water, that's not a natural thing that can happen. A human can swim, a human can step on the ground and walk, but walk on the surface of the water, that doesn't occur naturally. And thus a miracle is an act of God injected into the normal activities of human beings. Like these human beings were in the boat rowing in the middle of the storm. That's a normal thing that humans do, fighting the natural elements. But here comes Jesus walking on the water. The Bible presents that as an act, that's an act of God injected into the normal activities of man. Consider these examples with me. I just have a list of them on the screen. You can either read along with me or just listen as I read them, just as an example of what we're talking about regarding a miracle. First of all, there's Mark chapter 1, where this gospel writer says this of Jesus in verse 40 to 42. He's talking here about a leper. There were few diseases more dreaded than leprosy in ancient times. There was no cure for it. A person had to separate from society and suffer greatly until they died. A slow rotting away of the flesh. But look what happens. Mark 1 verse 40. And a leper came to Jesus, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him, saying, "If you're willing, you can make me clean." Moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I'm willing, be cleansed." Immediately, the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. There's the example of Mark chapter and John chapter 9, sampling a couple of different Gospels here, though they are all through the four Gospels. In John chapter 9, we read about a man who had been born blind. In John chapter 9, we read in verse 1, "As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth." And as the text indicates here in this chapter, people knew this man had been blind all his life. And so we read in verse 6, beginning, "When he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, 'Go, wash in the pool of Siloam,'" which is translated "sit." "So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, 'Is not this the man who used to sit and beg?' Others were saying, 'This is he.' So others were saying, 'No, but he's like him.' He kept saying, 'I am the one.' So they were saying to him, 'How then were your eyes open?' He answered, 'The man who is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, "Go to Siloam and wash." So I went away and washed and I received sight." This is not a natural phenomenon. You cannot take spit and clay and heal a man of his blindness. This is an act of God, as it's presented here in the Gospel of John, an act of God among the normal activities of human beings. There are so many impressive ones. Of course, we even have Jesus raising the dead. In John the 11th chapter, his three good friends who were dear to him, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, death struck their home. Lazarus died of an illness. And we read that days later, Jesus comes to this scene of sadness and drastically changes it according to John's record. In John chapter 11, beginning in verse 38, "So Jesus, again being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, 'Remove the stone.' Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?' So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you. You've heard me. I know that you always hear me, but because of the people sitting around, I said it, so that they may believe that you sent me.' And when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth.' The man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with the wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, 'Unbind him and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. Those are Bible miracles. Sometimes we use the expression miracle in a very accommodative way in our culture, in a very loose way. Somebody has a very serious illness and the doctors are perplexed as to how to treat the person. And then after a few months, there is this great health, this reversal of the condition. And the doctors are amazed, and sometimes people say, it's a miracle. Well, is it clearly a miracle? Was it instantaneous? Was it clearly an act of God? Oftentimes there is no evidence of that. Somebody's in a terrible auto accident and the authorities come and they see the car and it's so mangled and they wonder, how can anybody survive that? And they extract the victim from the car and they live. And somebody else sees the car and says, it's a miracle that person survived. Well, it might be a very impressive thing that happened, but there could be some very reasonable physical explanation as to how the person was in that accident, but still, because of the seatbelt, the airbag, the pocket they were in the car, and that they were just moved in such a way or whatever, and they survived it. That can happen. That's not necessarily a miracle. And then there are people who claim to perform miracles or to have a miracle. Oftentimes these are vague faith healings, where nobody really knows the person, and somebody's brought before a crowd and they claim to have a bad back and then they stand up and they're just fine. The illness sometimes is vague and then hard to detect and it's not discernible and people don't really know, have they really had that condition? These kinds of vague kind of faith healings, that's not what the Bible is talking about. We're seeing, in the case of healings, people who were clearly diseased or handicapped, and people knew it. And they had been, in almost every one of these cases, for years, if not all their life, in that condition. And in the case of Lazarus, he's in the tomb 4 days. They didn't embalm, this culture didn't embalm. They wrapped the body with these linens. They had spices in them. And they didn't want that tomb opened up because of the stench. But there was no stench. Because Jesus brought him back to life, according to John's record. Now, those are the kinds of things you see talked about here in the four Gospels. And I want you to understand this about Bible miracles, because they do occur elsewhere in the Bible, but understand something about them. They're not on every page. The miracles of the Bible are characteristically spread out. They're sporadic, and they're really clustered. There are four periods in Bible history where you see miracles taking place, but there are other periods where there are no miracles recorded for long periods of time, hundreds of years, and none are taking place. You see them clustered around the Exodus, where the Jews or Hebrews were brought out of Egyptian bondage, and you're familiar with the 10 plagues and those kinds of things that happened. And then you see a cluster of miracles during the divided kingdom, during the prophecy years of Elijah and Elisha. But then you go for hundreds of years, you just don't read of miracles in the Bible. And then you come to the New Testament, and during the ministry of Jesus, and fourth of all, during the early years of the church, during the New Testament record of the church, the first Christians, some of them and some of these apostles were doing miracles. All the apostles really were doing miracles. And even some of the early disciples and teachers were doing miracles to prove that their message was from God. But then as you look at the record after the New Testament among those who claim to be Christians, the occurrence of miracles just fall right off. It don't happen. So understand something. The Bible doesn't just record life on earth where there's just like this miracle every day. Not at all. And that's why when the writers write about them and the witnesses in the record behold them, they are seen as incredibly unusual. And thus they conclude it's an act of God. And there's no other explanation than it's an act of God because it's so drastic. We have to be honest here. And those who believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we all need to be honest. And those who have a hard time believing it or completely have rejected it, we all need to be honest about this. And be fair about it. And thorough about it. And anybody who reads these accounts, admittedly, these are hard to believe. And even as a believer myself, I would propose to you, that's a good reaction. We should read these things and scratch our heads and think, how could that happen? They should be hard to believe. And so we can understand Mr. Jefferson's skepticism. They're troubling to read. They're not common. We understand there's a lot of fraud in the world. There's a lot of deceit in the world. There are a lot of legends that humans have circulated about other people down through time. So why should a reasonable and intelligent person ever believe in these accounts? It's a great question. It reminds me of something. The colossal donut. I thought Alan Stiles was my friend. But some time ago, he recommended to me Shoppers Food Warehouse donuts. And a few weeks ago, we were having some people for a brunch, and Lori said, go get some donuts. And I thought, my friend Alan Stiles recommended Shoppers Food Warehouse donuts. And so I went in there. Have you seen these donuts? They're huge. The box says on them, colossal donuts. And they're extra big boxes. And I go in this grocery store. It was about 8:30 on a Saturday morning. You know, not many people are in a grocery store on Saturday morning. You know, there's a couple people around the fruit. And I look, and there are all these people back there at those donut cases. And I had to wait in line to get mine. And they're huge. And it was interesting that day as we had some guests over and people, we took them out of the box and we put them on a plate. And it was like that high. A dozen of donuts was on a plate. It was about that high. Okay? And I watched as people would take these donuts occasionally. It was sort of intimidating, you know. And finally, somebody would take it and they would start eating. One person in particular, I won't name the person. They started eating on the donut. It was like minutes later, I looked over there and they were just still eating on it. And then it was like minutes later, they were still eating on it. It took this person forever to eat that donut. That's an hyperbole, but you got the point. I thought Alan was my friend, but he hooked me up with those donuts and now there's a problem. But anyway. But you know what? People ate those donuts. Yeah, I ate one. I won't say how many, but I ate donuts too. And they were hard to eat. But you know how you ate one of those colossal donuts? One bite at a time. You just start nibbling away at it. This is a colossal issue. There are miracles recorded in the Bible. This is hard to believe. People walking on water, being healed of blindness, and being raised from the dead. This is a big issue. So you have to realize as you deal with it, that coming to a resolution about what you think about this, it takes time and effort. It's like eating a colossal donut. You don't do it quickly. You don't do it easily. You got to work at it. There's no quick answer here. You got to take one bite at a time at this. Out of this, you got to think about it. You got to eliminate some things. You got to accept some things. When something makes sense and there's no other alternative, you got to accept that. When something does not make sense and you've worked it and you've tried it and you've tested it and it doesn't hold water, you got to reject it. You got to just work through this. And admittedly, this is a colossal issue. So the question is it reasonable to believe that Jesus performed miracles as recorded in the New Testament? I'm going to give you three things where you to start on today. Again, it's a colossal issue. It's just a start. But consider these three things with me. First of all, the weight and credibility of the Bible documents. There are some documents that as soon as they're produced, people know they're fiction. Or even if they claim to be factual, not long after they're produced, they're exposed. For instance, about 15 years ago, there were some people in Europe who claimed to have Hitler's diaries, some copies of Hitler's diaries, and all the world was abuzz about it. But once the scholars began to examine the evidence, they were quickly rejected as fraud, and these people were uncovered as perpetuating a fraud. They were not legitimate diaries of Adolf Hitler. The Bible has not had that problem mostly through time. We live in a culture that is very skeptical of the Bible. That's fair. Questions should be asked. But did you know that for thousands of years that was not the case? You've got 2,000 years of Western civilization. Surely there were a lot of people who were not well learned and well taught and well read, who just listened and believed anything the Bible said. But there were a lot of people over the last several centuries who were very learned, very scholarly, very careful in reading things. They had no problems with accepting the legitimacy of the Bible documents, including Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why would they? one thing, the Bible documents have proven time and time again to be historically accurate. They're not talking about people and places and events that we can't verify. Oftentimes we can and have, and the more archaeologists dig, the more verification they find of the people and the places of the Bible. We talked last week about the manuscript transmission. The documents of the New Testament have been passed on more accurately than any other set of documents from ancient history. Test that. There's the objectivity of the writers. There's no personal gain they had from an earthly standpoint. There's no scandal or conspiracy attached to them. And we understand the more outlandish a claim a person has, the quicker people are to be skeptical and look for the untruthfulness in it. And then there are the fulfilled prophecies. The Old Testament contains hundreds of predictions about people, about nations, and especially about the Messiah who would come, that hundreds of years later you find in the New Testament are fulfilled. What do you do with it? How can you rectify the fact that documents were written hundreds of years before and predicted where a person was born, how he would die, how he would be buried, these kinds of things? All of that just adds credibility to the testimony of these books. For instance, if some stranger came up to you off the street and said, "Hey, did you know we're going to build a colony on Mars? The United States government, we're going to build a colony on Mars. Did you know that?" If it's some stranger off the street, you think, you know, has this person wandered out of a hospital, or, you know, is there some kind of problem here? But if you had a friend that worked in the aerospace industry, and you've known this person for years, and they walked up to you and they said, "You know, there are plans for the United States to start a colony on Mars." As hard as that is to believe, you would stop and say, oh, really? Because this person, you've known them to be a credible person. And you know that they have access, possibly, to information about space exploration. And so it would make you pause and think and evaluate that testimony, because you have, that person has credibility with you. Listen, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have a lot of characteristics about them where they earn credibility. And we understand that if a witness is credible, no matter how incredible their testimony is, they deserve to be heard out. They deserve a fair look. And the Bible and the Gospels in particular are credible to the point that we've got to take these things seriously and not lightly dismiss them. In other words, it's like this. For a record to record that people are deaf and blind and lame and they're healed, and that people are dead and brought back to life, we'd expect to find that in documents that are known for having no credibility, that are looked upon as being mythical. But that's not the kind of documents we find those records in. It's almost like if they're not true, they don't even fit in those kinds of documents. But those are the kinds of documents we find them in. Second of all, we've got to consider this in light of our own human limitations in time, in space, and experience. I'm going to have a conversation with Thomas Jefferson. I'm going to let you listen in. "Mr. Jefferson, do you believe that Jesus, or any man for that matter, could walk on water?" He would say no. If I said why, "Because it is not possible by the laws of nature for a man to walk on water." I asked Mr. Jefferson, "Do you believe that a man could touch and heal a blind man, just touch him and heal him? A man blind since birth." Mr. Jefferson would say no. "Mr. Jefferson, could a man raise another person from the dead?" And by the way, they've been dead 4 days, sealed in a tomb. "Could a man raise another man from the grave?" Mr. Jefferson would say no. "Mr. Jefferson, can a man fly?" Mr. Jefferson would say no. "Mr. Jefferson, can a man fly from one side of North America to the other side of North America in a matter of 4 hours?" Mr. Jefferson would say no. Because according to Mr. Jefferson's understanding, in his library, in his own experiences, and he had, folks, the best library in America at the time, he would conclude that all the evidence says that human beings cannot project themselves through the air and travel over 2,000 miles in a matter of 4 hours. Mr. Jefferson, can a man sit on one side of the earth and talk to another person on the other side of the earth and they hear each other's voices? Mr. Jefferson would say, well, of course not. Mr. Jefferson, can a man walk on the moon? Thomas Jefferson, by this point in our conversation, he was a very polite man, had a good sense of humor, very respectful man, would probably chuckle and say, no, sir, a man can't walk on the moon. Same basis that Mr. Jefferson would reject that Jesus could ever walk on the water. That is beyond his understanding, his experiences, his observations, and his understanding of the laws of physics and nature. The very reason why he would reject those things happening with Jesus would be the same reason he would reject that one day we could talk on a telephone across the earth to each other, fly in an airplane across North America, or even some man could walk on the moon. All those things were beyond the realm of experience of people who lived in the 18th and early 19th century. And if you would say to them that any of those things could take place, they would look at you like you just said a man could walk on the water. To them, it would be that unbelievable. But we understand that it's not. And we've all done those things. Not the walk on the moon, but we've flown in planes and we've talked on telephones, great distances, and so forth. We understand those things are possible. Though there have been people at certain times in history who thought they were impossible. Just because it's beyond the realm of what we think and have seen as possible does not make something impossible. Why? Because it may be beyond the realm of our understanding and experience. It may be beyond the laws that we know exist. Is there a God? Though it was not the view of the God of the Bible, and the view of God that I would assume most everybody here has, Mr. Jefferson would say yes to that. He believed that there was a creator. You know that, don't you? And he's documented for that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Not the ideas, but those are the words of Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence. If there's a God with the ability to create life, to create humans, and to endow them with certain rights, inalienable rights, then that God has abilities and powers and wisdom and strength that's way beyond us. And isn't it logical to accept that we don't have an understanding of all His power and we have not personally witnessed all that He could do at any point in time? I would propose to you that it is narrow-minded to say that a miracle could never occur. And by miracle, I mean the definition we used earlier, an act of God in the normal activities of man. An act of God that is against the natural order and law of things on earth. But of course, you know, think about it. If there have ever been miracles that took place, they would be rare. Because after all, they're a miracle. And they would be to the amazement of the witnesses. And that's what the Bible record contains. They're rare. And to the amazement of all the witnesses. And if miracles have ever taken place, they would be so impressive that somebody would have been moved to put them in a legitimate, credible record. And the Bible is a credible record when you examine the typical measures of what makes a credible document. And third of all, what you've got to consider here at the beginning is that Jesus is a package. you can cut the instances of Jesus healing the lame and restoring hearing to the deaf and walking on the water and raising the dead. You can cut those out. But if you accept all the words of Jesus, you're left with a problem. Because there's an inseparable link between what Jesus said and what he did in these miracles. For instance, John chapter 10. He says in verse 17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life." That's a reference to his crucifixion. "So that I may take it again. No one takes it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from the Father." Jesus says that he is going to voluntarily lay down his life. He's also going to take it back up. The reference to his resurrection. Later in that chapter, Jesus makes this statement in chapter 10, verse 37. "If I do not do the works of my Father..." This is a reference to his signs and miracles, as he just mentioned, works of the Father. "Do not believe me." In other words, don't believe me with my words. "But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works. So that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father." You know what Jesus is saying? Jesus says, don't just take my word for it that I came from the Father. Don't just take my word for it that I have come to bring peace and understanding and truth and salvation and the way to God. Don't just take my words for it. Look at my works. Look at my deeds, which prove that God was in me, that the Father was in me. Then you'll know that my words are believable because of the incredible deeds that's been done. What Mr. Jefferson did is what many people do, at least in their minds. They're moved by the words of Jesus. They're touched by the compassion of Jesus. They're impressed with the courage of Jesus. Yet the stories of the miracles trouble them. The claim that he came from God sounds outlandish and probably closer to home than what most would admit. The requirement to abandon self and turn from living the way we want to live in a selfish, rebellious manner and to follow after him is just a bit too much. Most people want a kind and inspiring moral teacher. But an almighty Lord who can walk on the water, calm the seas, heal the blind, and raise the dead at just a word is just too much. Because that's the same Lord that calls us from our sins. And it's not honest and it's not fair to cut and paste with the four Gospels. Because here's the point. Either they are legitimate sources or they're bogus. They're either believable and credible or they're fairy tales. Which is it? Because we know there is a line of manuscripts from the early centuries that prove to us that what we have is an accurate representation of what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John originally wrote. More than any other set of ancient documents. The idea that somebody has tampered with them, which is what really Jefferson thought, doesn't make sense. But you know what? Thomas Jefferson lived at a time before a lot of those manuscripts had been uncovered. And he was going on his own experiences, not what was truly possible. So the idea that somebody has tampered with those, there's just not the evidence there. But there is evidence opposite. And so, either Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have integrity in what they're saying, all of it, or we should take them and get as many as we can find and not just shred them, we should burn them. Either they are legitimate or they're bogus. But it's interesting, for all these centuries, hardly anyone will make the claim that they are entirely bogus. Mr. Jefferson spent hours separating what he thought shouldn't belong there to what he thought should belong there. But he retained a lot. Why? Because all still want to salvage the image of the good moral teacher who has this great example of unselfish love, but they want to toss out the Almighty Lord who calmed the sea and raised the dead and commands us to repent. And why is it that people keep making that separation, and why they can't just completely flush Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John away and just completely abandon the whole thing? Why? There's just something about Jesus. When people are pushed to make a choice and make a stand, there is something about Jesus, even in His stripped down human version, that we can't walk away from and we can't abandon. There is just something about Jesus that people can't stand up and say, this is completely a joke and He's a fraud and we should never accept any of it. People don't do that. Here's the point. You can't just pick what you want. He's a package. Because these documents are a package. And it's very fitting, and I didn't talk to Stephen about this ahead of time, and he didn't talk to me, and I appreciate what he had to say. Because Stephen's exactly right. The cross is just part of the picture. You know, there were two other people down on the cross that day. They were not the Savior of the world. Because Jesus died on the cross because He fulfilled the prophecies of the Old Testament. And He died on the cross as the pure and completely righteous Lamb of God as a sacrifice. And whenever He talked about dying on the cross, He also talked about that on the third day He would rise again. He laid down His life according to the Father's will, and He took it back up again. That's the package. What are you going to do with it? John ends his gospel by saying, verse 30 and 31 of chapter 20, therefore many other signs. This is a reference to His resurrection. Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in His name. Can a man walk on water? No. A mere man with mere human abilities can't walk on water. Jesus was a man. He was more than that. When His birth is announced and predicted, Matthew records, quote from Isaiah, behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call His name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. Going back to the Gospel of John, he writes at the beginning in chapter 1, verse 14, in the Word, speaking of Christ, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we saw His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. The New Testament says that Jesus was of Nazareth and He was a human being in flesh and blood, but He actually came from the Father. He was actually the true representation of the Father. He was the only begotten. He was the Son of God who lived in human flesh. And that's why when He spoke, people could come back to life. That's why when He touched the leper, He would be healed. That's who Jesus is, according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. He is the Son of God. And you see, all of our issues with God, all of our issues are addressed in Jesus when He became a man. God, where are you? God, who are you? God, what are you like? God, do you understand me? Do you even care about me? Do you understand what I'm going through? God, do you know what it's like here? God, what will you do to help me? All those issues with God are answered in Jesus, the Son of Man, the Son of God. Because when you see Jesus and when you accept Jesus, all of Jesus, all of His words, all of His deeds, all of His miracles, all of His power, all of His love, you'll see that God has come. And He's lived among us. And He showed us who He was. And He taught us what He wanted. And he's done the thing that we needed most. He's made it possible for us to find God and be right with God, to be free from our sins, and one day, like him, raised to die no more and live with him forever. God bless you as you try to sort out Jesus, fact or fiction.